Okay, good afternoon. I'm very excited to resume our afternoon kollel, and as always, we want to thank the Frohlich Financial Group, Avi Frohlich, for his generosity for sponsoring Torah Learning 3 afternoons a week. It's really a very special thing. It should be a great schus for the family and for the financial group, and we are deeply, deeply grateful. This week's learning is sponsored by Reb Moshe and Shelley Brand in memory of Sarah Bas Yosef and Sarah Bas Mordechai Pinchas HaKohen. Thank you for your generosity as well. We're still deciding what we're going to do in our slot in the afternoon kollel this year. We listed contemporary halachic topics, and we may go with that. I certainly solicit your feedback, whether over the last few years we've done a Masechet of Gemara where we went through a perek, we learned a Blat Gemara, you know, a Blat Shir, we've done Shas Sugyas, and I thought the contemporary halachic topics we ended with last year allowed for some diversity and for each unit to be distinct, so if a person missed a week, they didn't miss any sense of a continuity. So while we're still deciding, I want to discuss with you this afternoon what I think is a fascinating subject. It's a sad subject. It's a timely subject because yesterday we marked Kristallnacht, which of course is the anniversary of the horrific night and couple of days in which the Nazis in Germany destroyed so many countless shuls and obliterated Jewish communities. My family personally was deeply affected. My grandparents, my paternal grandparents who owned a store in Berlin, their store was destroyed. My grandfather was arrested. Ultimately, we are very blessed that they were able to get out actually before the war, but they did suffer in being beaten and exiled, and my grandmother's heroism was able to get my grandfather home, and whatever the whole story is, how she was able to secure visas to be able to get out and come to America. So we've just marked the calendar, and the days in which we're living are a reminder that the horrors of Kristallnacht are not part of the ancient past, but the idea that there are enemies around us and there are anti-Semitic sentiments that seek continuously to annihilate us, and it's the fact that it's back within the realm of possibility. You can't look at the news one week without seeing another swastika, another Jew beaten. And we're not talking about an obscure town in Europe. We're talking about in Brooklyn, New York. We're talking about around America. It's a reminder that these forces remain intact and their nefarious aspirations remain of our concern. So what does that have to do with our topic? So Kristallnacht is what motivated this question. And the question I want to address with you really was written up in an article by Rabbi Joseph Pollack, who was the rabbi at the Hillel at Boston University, and he wrote an article many years ago in which he addressed the following question we're going to look at in depth. Mostly his article points us in the direction of the Maror Makomos, the sources we're going to look at, and a few others that we've added. The question of what happens if a Nazi apologizes, is remorseful. Do we accept an apology of a Nazi? A. B. Let's take it a step further. That Nazi wants to undergo the process of Giur. The Nazi wants to convert and become a full-fledged observant Torah Jew. Could someone with blood on their hands, guilty of such a heinous crime unparalleled in human history, genuinely and authentically transform themselves and be eligible, worthy of joining our people? So we'll be able to see a little bit about Geirus, a little bit about Tshuva, a little bit about Mechila. And that this question is not the first to address it in our time. And then we'll end with, hopefully we'll have time, but another application that continues to be in our day. By a show of hands, who will not buy a German car? Who will not use a German product? So certainly we have a somewhat homogeneous demographic represented here this afternoon in our afternoon kollel. But there is a generation who continues to object, to protest buying German products, refusing to fund or give a profit to a German people, even though the companies or the individuals who will benefit or profit from being a consumer of German products today weren't alive when the Holocaust happened. They're the children, if not the grandchildren or great-grandchildren, of those who perpetrated the atrocity. So what does halacha have to say? Is there halachic precedent for the idea of boycotting those who have harmed us? One can argue, we'll get to this in the past, that if you're going to boycott anyone who's ever persecuted, exiled, or harmed us, you're going to be sitting alone with no clothing and no car to drive in a dark room. You'll be there'll be nothing that you're able to enjoy. So let's take it slowly, and let's take it from the top. So first of all, source number one comes from this article, which was printed in the Jewish Law Association Studies at Boston University, where Rabbi Pollack was the rabbi at the Hillel. And there in source number one, the title of his article, Forgiving the Germans Paradigms and Dialectics from Halacha. And he raises the question, and why it arose. About 10 years ago, he writes, way back then a young German who was not yet 30 arrived at my study with a request. He was part of a group of young Christians, he explained, who had visited Auschwitz as part of their religious education. At the end of the visit, each member of the group made a vow to give up a year of his or her life as penance for the Holocaust their parents and grandparents had authored. His particular penance was to volunteer for a year to improve together with Cesar Chavez and his followers the plight of the much-abused migrant farm workers. His request was simply for the use of a room and a telephone at our campus ministry center. I was deeply moved at the time. On the one hand, I remember there had been a gadage. Nothing stands in the way of repentance. On the other, I was troubled that both as a Jew and a survivor, I needed to be part of his penance. He certainly did not know I was a survivor, and in the end, I provided him with the quarters he sought. Here then was a young man who felt that he had inherited the iniquity of his forebears, and that he had to take some responsibility for them. I do not know whether he sought forgiveness from God for their iniquities, although I suspect as much. What I am aware of is his deep religious need for moral cleansing, and that a strategy for this cleansing meant in some way doing the opposite, and thereby in his soul and the German soul perhaps undo what the Nazis had done. Whereas, in the article he related earlier, Krupp and Farben engaged in Jewish slave workers and let them work until they died, his penance consisted in doing everything in his power to improve the lot of Hispanic laborers in California and Ohio, who each day breathed in carcinogenic crop sprays and were denied toilets and clean drinking water in their workplaces. Fascinating for this young German, the act of tshuva was not in fact to make a tikkun among the very people who were the victims, but to make a tikkun of the behavior. It's like a cheftza gavra. He wasn't trying to do a tshuva to the gavras that he had hurt, but it was the practice that he was trying to repair. Questions for this paper present themselves. What does Allah have to say first about the repentant Nazi? Second, are the descendants of Nazis born, say after 1943, to be treated as innocent victims of their parents' evil or as tainted by their crimes? Are there consequences? Third, is there a halachically identifiable role for Jews in any process of penance by Nazis or their innocent descendants? And fourth, is there a halachic analog to the Holocaust? Or do we say because its crimes are so unimaginable, halacha here is simply inapplicable? Fifth, is there a halachic concept of collective guilt, such as that when we speak of Nazi sympathetic collectivity, about whom? About whose offspring? Moral halachic statements may be made. And finally, can a halachic case be made for the notion implicit in most of these questions that evil can be undone? And if so, would this be true of all evil? So there Rabbi Pollack lists a series of questions in our short time this afternoon. Obviously, we will not be able to address them all. Even in his article, while he addresses more than the ones we will share, he's not able to comprehensively go over them. But it's a complicated sugya. Do you say anyone living in Germany at the time, even if they were not implicit, they were complicit? Do you say that even if they weren't a Nazi, but if they were a bystander, if they allowed the atrocity to happen, how do you evaluate their role, their responsibility? It's a significant question. Is there collective responsibility and collective punishment? He asks here this series of questions. The first one that he raises, the question of forgiveness, famously was a big machlokas between Simon Wiesenthal and Elie Wiesel. We're going to get to the Torah sources, don't worry. I know it's an afternoon kolo. It was a famous machlokas. Simon Wiesenthal had a best-selling book called The Sunflower. I don't know if anyone heard of it or read it. And he talks about his work camp experience, and he was brought to the bedside of a dying Nazi. And the man turned to Wiesenthal, and he confessed his crimes and his horrific wrongdoings against the Jewish people. And he asked Simon Wiesenthal, as a representative of all of his victims, to grant him forgiveness. In that last moment on this world, with fear of what the world to come would bring, he turned to Wiesenthal and asked him to represent all of his victims and to grant him forgiveness. And Wiesenthal describes that he couldn't grant the soldier that wish because some things are simply too heinous, too atrocious to forgive. And he describes that for the rest of his life, Simon Wiesenthal said, he remained tortured by that request and tortured by his reaction to it. Was it unkind? Was it unfair that he didn't grant this dying man the request that he asked for, even though he seemed to be genuinely remorseful? He described that moment was torturous. He was unable to grant in the death camp, but he did grant in an extreme later in life in another scenario, Wiesenthal. 1966, Albert Speer was the Minister of Armaments and War Production for Hitler, and he had served a full 20-year sentence of the Nuremberg Court. He published his memoirs that had an apparently sincere statement of remorse And Simon Wiesenthal wrote in response to the publishing of those memoirs. He wrote, quote, "This man has served his sentence. He has admitted his guilt. He has shown contrition. More than this cannot be demanded of him. And he is therefore acceptable. The forgiveness he couldn't show the soldier, he was able to later show to one of Hitler's closest advisors." Elie Wiesenthal disagreed. And he felt, Elie Wiesel disagreed. First of all, he famously said, when asked about whether one could forgive the Nazis, he said, "Who asked for forgiveness?" Meaning, has there been some collective accounting, remorse, request for forgiveness that we should even be debating whether we can grant them that forgiveness? He fundamentally took a different view. And this was a question, I spoke about it 1 year on Yom Kippur, as at least a teaser or introduction to the drasha, which was, are there things that are unforgivable? Or do we believe that ultimately everything is forgivable? There are things that are irreversible. You can't bring 6 million lives back. And if a person commits even one act of murder, you can't bring that one life back. But can a murderer do tshuva? Can a murderer repent? That certainly we have a precedent. We just read about it, Cain and Hevel. And we have precedent throughout the Torah. Are there things that are so egregious, so heinous, that if a person violates that boundary, they have forfeited their neshama, their soul? The Rambam talks about the ability to expunge, to purge that neshama, the tzelem Elokim, within ourselves. So maybe there are lines that we can cross where we've essentially forfeited not our humanity, we forfeited our godliness by our ability to even behave in that manner. So that's a question, big adol, and we're going
to
see that question.
One thing, but
We'll see that question in particular. As Phil says, even if you could argue a person could grant forgiveness, or that those things are forgivable, who grants that forgiveness? We'll get to that soon. So, the conversation starts source number two. This is a tshuva from Chukas Hager. Who wrote Chukas Hager? Of Moshe Alevi Steinberg. And this tshuva was published in the 1960s. He was the Rav of Kiryat Yam. And why did he write this? A former Nazi who was directly responsible for genocidal activity had approached a local Rav in Eretz Yisrael for conversion, for Giyur. And that local Rav sought Rav Steinberg, the Rav of Kiryat Yam, the Baal HaChukas HaGer's opinion about whether a Nazi is even eligible to be considered for conversion. So let's take a look at his tshuva. He says, "B'kashin l'chavaz dati b'inyan nachri l'sha'avar chavar p'il b'maflega Nazis ha'yidua." He says, regarding a non-Jew who previously was a member of the Nazi party, v'yesh l'aniach sh'ba'atzmo yishtatei b'masim nifsha'im, who himself was participated in such horrific crimes, z'ka'ez chazar b'tshuva v'rotzel esgayer im mekablam oso. And now he's repentant and he wants to not only live a noble, virtuous life, but he wants to live a Jewish life. A Jewish life. Would we accept such a convert? So he begins with Steinberg and he says, if we approach this from a purely emotional standpoint, if we approach it from a nationalistic standpoint, if we look at it from humanitarian concerns or national honor, it is clear that there's nothing to consider. An arch enemy, a person who's done such horrific, irreversible things, who created such unprecedented loss and suffering and pain, what would you be saying about the honor of the Jewish people if you could accept such a person with such blood dripping from their hands? Some people have forfeited their right towards certain things. This individual, live a noble life, try to repent by being an upstanding member of society, but the opportunity to join the Jewish people, it's lost. You're no longer entitled to it. If we look at it from purely emotional, humanitarian, or national honor perspective, how difficult it would be to declare about him, you are our brother. Nine people for a minion, and the former Nazi, he rounds out the minion. Yamod for Shlishi, a former Nazi with blood dripping on his hands. How difficult it would be to call him Achenu Ata. And what you see, by the way, is you cannot accept a convert if you're not prepared to say, Achenu, you're my brother. The most oft-repeated mitzvah in the Torah is V'ahavtem es hager, the mitzvah, the responsibility to love the convert. not to make him stand out, not to make her feel as an outsider. They are full insiders. The Zohar writes that the soul of those who convert was present at Har Sinai. Was present at Har Sinai. I heard that for a long time. I thought it was a Baba Maisa to make converts feel good. But then I found the source that we have a notion that the souls of those who ultimately convert were, even at the moment of Har Sinai, present as we became forged as a people. Are we prepared to say the soul of somebody who could perpetrate such crimes was present at Har Sinai? Are we ready to say Acheinu Ata? He says, but all of that is if we approach it emotionally or as a humanitarian or nationalistically. But if you look at it from pure dry halacha, he doesn't mean dry as a judgment of the experience of learning halacha. He means, thank you so much, he means from a purely halachic analytical perspective, if you apply the pure halachic standards and criteria, by what right would you have to reject this person? The sigyas of the Gemara, through the Shulchan Aruch, and through the later poskim, talk about Kabbalah sol mitzvos, the sincerity of accepting the yoke of heaven. It's a halacha that a ger can't accept chutz midavar echad. You can't say, I'll convert with the exception of this one thing. We have a Beis Din of Giur down here, of which I have the privilege of serving the Menahel, a group of volunteer rabbanim in South Florida. We get together once a month, and we rely heavily on sponsoring rabbis, but we develop relationships with conversion candidates, and we take them through that. We take them through that process. It's always very beautiful when there are sincere, sincere conversion candidates. In fact, we just did a Giur a few months ago. We cover territory not just of South Florida, but there are other areas beyond South Florida that don't have local Batei Din who we try to help out. So I won't, not wanting to reveal any details, I won't even say where these people flew in from, but it was a fascinating case of the son, a man who grew up in Germany, a Jew who grew up in Germany, whose father was one of the heads of the German Jewish community after the war. And where he moved to, he fell in love with a non-Jewish German girl, who I don't know her ancestry or history or what her parents or grandparents were doing during the war. And she was identified as sincere. She went through the process of conversion entirely, accepting all of halacha, and really they are leaders in their community right now, doing extraordinary things. It's a gir kahalacha that we can be amazingly proud of. It's fascinating, a fascinating, fascinating gir. But most recently we're facing a question, can you be megayer? Here's just an example. Can you be megayer a veterinarian? Now you look at me, you say, why couldn't you be megayer a veterinarian? Because one of the things that a veterinarian has to do as part of a normal veterinary practice, from what I understand, is you have to sterilize and spay animals. And there's a halach of siris, there's halachas involved. A male animal, female animal, even if you're the owner of the animal, can you even ask a non-Jew, is it Amir al-Akam, to have them do it for you? So let's say you have a veterinarian who says, I'm going to keep Shabbos kalacha, kashrus kalacha, make brachas, the highest standards of everything from A to Z. However, this is my parnasa. I can't run a successful veterinary practice to the exclusion of being able to do what is one. Is that considered chutz midavar echad? So Rav Moshe qualifies, what's chutz midavar echad? What does it mean that I'm prepared to follow all of halacha except for one thing? How do you understand that? Does a chutz midavar echad mean as an act of rebellion? I accept Torah as binding, halacha as binding, but I refuse to accept that. So that's what the Torah, that's what the Gemara was talking about. Chutz midavar echad maybe means that, I think that that's just a chumrah. That's what Rav Moshe says. Is that I see a lot of people don't really keep that thing. So I'm not keeping it, not because I'm, as an act of rebellion, as an act of rejection that that's bound on me by the Torah or by Hashem, but as an act of comfort and convenience. Just like most people don't, we sometimes have that too. It's an indictment of our community. Sometimes you are dealing with a potential ger, and you say, look, we really want to help you through this process, but your lifestyle, your standards are not kedasu kedin. You're not living a halachic life. They say, Rabbi, you have a lot of members of your community. I want to keep Shabbos like that person, not like you. That person keeps kosher in the home but eats out. That's the kind of Jew I want to convert to be, which is an indictment on our community, that they could point to anyone and say, I want to take that lower or light standard. So there are criteria. And the halacha criteria tell us who's eligible, who's ineligible. You're ineligible if it's chutz midavar echad, for example. But What he points out, the Chukas Ager of Steinberg, is the fact that somebody has that past does not, from a halachic standpoint, make them ineligible. Hine Kayin HaRoteh HaRishon B'Toldos HaEnoshis. Kayin, who is the first murderer in the history of humanity, Amar Lefi HaMedrash Breshes Rabba Asisa Tshuva V'Nishprasti. Kayin himself says, I did tshuva and I was forgiven. And the Medrash Rab in Shmo says, Amar Iyov B'Chutz Layol and Gersh Ena Kodesh Baruch Hu Posel Lebriel Kol Mekabel HaSharam Neftachim B'Chol Shah. Kodesh Baruch Hu doesn't reject anyone. The gates are always open if someone sincerely wants to walk through them. V'Kol Kishu Mevakesh Likanes Yikanes. It's a whole separate topic. The Rush did not write the Psalm Rush. It was a forgery. Who is the real author and does it have a place in Halacha? If in fact it's a forgery and not authored by the Rush, it's a fascinating but very separate topic. So the Psalm Rush, the Chief of Psalm Rush writes that we can accept Gerim converts from anyone, even from descendants of Amalek. And he says, and he refers us to the Gemara in Gittin and Gemara in Sanhedrin, which we're going to look at more closely inside a moment. Shmunitan Arasha Yatza Hatana Reb Meir, Ubinuz Radan, Rav Tabachim, Achre Shaharag, Veshavach Rivos Yudim, Mikol Pesha, also Tshuva Vizgayer. Nebuz Radan, the Babylonian, who after he murdered countless Jews, himself did Tshuva and converted. Vechazal Lonisra Olomarsh, Nebuz Radan, Ger Tzedekaya. So Lachain and Bezdin, Meshukna Shunus, Charet, Becharata, Gemura, Chaza, Betshuva, Shlema, Misamets, Beknos, Likanis, Tachas, Kanfe, Ashkina. Well, the Mistatras, Eza, Kavana, Shalana, Yishis, Okabal, Sora, Emit, Saralachakus, Likabal, Chazayudis. So he says, if the court is convinced that there's genuine remorse and it's complete repentance and that there's pure motive, in other words, that he's not converting in order to exonerate himself or absolve himself of his sins, he's not converting in order to marry a woman or get a certain job or be worthy of some honor or be able to re-enter society. He has no ulterior motive. He's a Ger Tzedek. He genuinely wants to convert because he's prepared to be Mekabel, O Malchus Shemayim, and all of Halacha, not Chutz Midavar Echad. So he says, he concludes, you cannot reject him. So if you explore just from emotional standards, humanitarian standards, nationalistic standards, of course you're going to reject. How could you say Acheinu Ata to a Nazi? But if you look from purely halachic standards and its precedent, which we'll explore more closely momentarily, then it would be very hard to argue that you can reject him.
Do we differentiate between somebody who was destructive of bodies or property and one who was not involved in physical
activity? I don't know that you distinguish, but certainly here we're talking about even somebody who we know is guilty of those atrocities. It said in the question that he participated in the murder of Jews. And then he continues, so maybe we found a great loophole. Why can we reject him not on the grounds that he was a Nazi? Because in Halacha, there is no exclusion of a Nazi. Why? Because his left arm was cut off, and therefore he can't fulfill the mitzvah tefillin. Came in Shein Aroy Labila, Bila Ma'akeves. To halachic terminology, bila means the korban mincha. If there's not enough room in the kli to mix the flour and the wood, if you can't create the korban mincha, it doesn't have to be mixed. Anyone here, if during the daf, you still remember back to Menach? It doesn't have to be mixed. It has to be eligible to be mixed. So kol roy labila ain bila ma'akeves. But it has to be roy. So over here too, he's ain't a roy to put tefillin on. He doesn't even have an arm. Before you talk about did he put tefillin on, he doesn't even have an arm to put tefillin on. So maybe you want to say about this fellow, he's missing an arm. And if he's missing an arm and he can't put on tefillin, so that would be chutz l'davar echad. And then he wrote, he says, you can't say that. And the whole argument is false. Why? If you're missing an arm, or you have a gangrene or paralyzed arm, there are all questions in halacha, you don't put it on the other arm. People make that mistake and think, if you can't put it on that arm, you just put it on the other arm. You can't put it on the other arm is as if you're not putting it on any arm, because that arm is not chayiv. So let's say a person has a paralyzed arm. You have this question with lo aleinu rachmana litzlan stroke victims, paralyzed in half their body. Do they still put tefillin on their arm? So he points out, that which the Gemara says, when you're exempt from the tefillin of the arm, it doesn't mean you're exempt from tefillin altogether. You still wear the tefillin sharosh. The Ramah answered that. If you can't put it on your left arm, you don't put it on your right arm, you're exempt altogether. As I said, it's a misnomer. A person sometimes has a cast or a bandage, so they say, I'm going to put it on my other arm. You're not yotzei the mitzvah. It's a bracha levatala to make the bracha on the other arm. You're not obligated on the other arm. You're either obligated on that arm or you're exempt from that arm. But you're not obligated on the, unless you're ambidextrous, maybe, you're not obligated on the other arm, but we view them as two separate mitzvahs. Certainly Ashkenazim, we make two brachas. So we view the tefillin shayad, tefillin shalrosh, and therefore, even if you're exempt from the shayad, you're still obligated in the shalrosh. So this guy, this non-Jew, this Nazi Nachri, who was missing an arm, you can't say it's chutz midavarachad because he's missing his arm, because he could still put it on his head. Plus, you could argue the fact that he'd be exempt altogether, even if he couldn't, that's not chutz midavarachad. Chutz midavarachad doesn't mean that he's not fulfilling the mitzvah, because by choice, it means that he has no choice. He's honest when it comes to that mitzvah. Okay, so that's what the Chukas Hager answers, is that if you analyze it from an emotional perspective, then of course you'll reject this applicant. But if you analyze it from a halachic perspective, if he meets all the criteria, he's willing to follow halacha kedasa gedin from A to Z, and nachutz midavarachad, and he's sincere, and he has pure motivations, even the question of motivations. I know I'm throwing a lot of tangents at you. First of all, that's my style, so I'm not going to apologize. But second of all, we could discuss geiris, hilchos geiris another time. Chutz midavarachad, or nachutz midavarachad, the question of motivation. Ishus, can someone convert from marriage? So in contemporary geiris, this is a question our Beis Din deals with every single time that we meet. Every time we meet, often, and I don't mean to generalize, I won't say where they're from. Jews from a particular country, let's just say maybe in the Middle East, whose flag is in our lobby, who live in South Florida, and they're not religious, never were, chilonim, and they meet some non-Jewish girl and fall in love, and then their mother says, if you marry her, I will kill you. You need to take her to a Beis Din, figure this out, because you cannot marry a non-Jew. If you intermarry, I will literally kill you. So they come to our Beis Din, and they entertain the possibility, what's involved, what's the process, how long, what will it take. And do you know what happens often? The woman, the non-Jewish woman who they met, falls in love. Torah, halacha, Judaism, the richness of our meaning of our life. He says, whoa, 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 I didn't sign up for this. What? Correct. So sometimes we have a beautiful thing where someone who grew up chiloni becomes a chozer b'tshuva, and it's an amazing thing that he met this non-Jewish woman. It was the best thing that ever happened to him, because instead of losing one, you gain two. It's a net gain of, instead of losing one, you gain two. It's unbelievable. But often they break up, and she continues and converts, and he said, I never really signed up for that intensity. That's not really what I'm interested in. So the whole question of for marriage, the Achiezer, there's a whole, he has a big discussion of how do you define for marriage today. You go back to Shimshon, the Rambam, that Shimshon made those women convert before he was willing to marry them. There's a whole discussion. Okay, so what was the Gemara in Sanhedrin that he was referring to? The Chukas Hager, when he said, what do you mean? We have a precedent for other evil, wicked people who did terrible things against our people, who nevertheless we accepted them for conversion. So he's referring to the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Tzad Yivav, Amud Beis, source number 3.
Hold off.
Source number 3. Says the Gemara Sanhedrin. Amar Rava. Tinflas meh kud naisa narga de parzala. De shalav be parzala shodla Nebuchadnezzar and Nebuzradan. Nebuchadnezzar sent Nebuzradan 300 mule loads of iron axes that could prevail over iron. Kulu blasinu chadosha b'yishlaim. One gate of Yishlaim swallowed them all the axes shattered. They tried to use these axes to break the siege of Yishlaim, and they all shattered. Shenema pituchei yachad. So Nebuzradan wanted to withdraw. Omar, he said, I don't want them to do to me what they did to Sancheirav. So Nafka call of Omar, a heavenly voice went out and said, Shavar bar Shavar, leper the son of a leper. Nebuzradan, Shavar, Nebuzradan, leap into battle and conquer Yerushalayim. The Mata Zimna de Mikdash Shechara, for the time has come for the temple to be destroyed. And for the sanctuary to be, the heichal to be burned. Poshle chad naragas, and Nebuzradan had one axe that was left. Asa machi bakufa the iftach, he went and struck the gate with the end of the axe, and it opened. Shenemar yivada kemevi lamala bezvach eitz kardumos. A very troubling Gemara, because it means our enemy was willing and ready to walk away, and who's the one who encouraged him to stick with it? Who is the who is behind the heavenly voice? Nafka kala va'amar, a voice went out. Who is behind the heavenly voice? Because it was destined for the Beis HaMikdash or the Heichal to be destroyed, he had a job to finish. Havakatova azal adamata lehechala, he proceeded through the city killing until he got to the Heichal. Adlik beinura, he set it on fire, gava heichala, the sanctuary ascended heavenward. Darchu beimin shemaya, they trod on it from heaven, pushing it back down, quoting a pasuk. Kazaycha daita, Nebuzradan became arrogant. He was being successful. That one last axe enabled him to break through. And he was murdering everyone in his path, and he lit the Heichal on fire. So what happened? He became arrogant. Nafka bas kalav amalei, ama ketila katalt. Before you become so arrogant that you are the victor, that you've triumphed, you killed a deceased people. Meaning, says the Kodesh Baruch Hu, they were destined for this, and therefore it's not your greatness or your acumen or your might which is successful. Hechala kaya kalis, it's a burned sanctuary that you burned. Kimcha tchina tchinas, it's ground flour that you ground. Ela kemach. Now continuing, Nebuzradan saw the blood of Zechariah seething through the floor of the temple. We talk about this in the kinos of Tisha B'Av. We tell the story. The blood of the prophet Zechariah that was refused to be absorbed in the floor of the Beis HaMikdash. Amalu, he said to the Kohen, "My high, Amru Lei, Dam Zvachim Udish Tapich." It's the blood of the offerings, the Karbonos. Amalu, who? Aitavan, I'll say Yimidamu. Let me see. Bring the blood of another animal. I don't believe you. I don't buy it. So Kase, they slaughtered another animal. Vuluidmu, and they were incomparable. Amalun of Uzradan said, Galuli, so well, whose blood is this for real? Why is this blood seething from the ground that refuses to be absorbed or cleaned? And if you don't, Ilo, Sarikna l'chul b'sreichu b'masreika d'parzala. I'm going to tear your flesh with an iron comb. That's a pretty convincing argument. So Amrulay, so they said, Hai Kohen v'Navihu. Zechariah was the Kohen and Navi. D'inaki l'li Yisrael b'churbanad Yerushalayim u'ktalu, they killed him. He was prophesizing. Who killed him? Who knows Tana? Who killed him? The Jews killed him. The Jews themselves killed him. Amar lehu, Nebuzradan said, Ana mefais analei. I will appease him. Aiti Rabbanan, and kati lavei. So he brought Rabbanan, meaning the Jews killed their own priest, their own prophet. Let me avenge his blood by killing the Jews. And who do you kill if not the leaders, the Rabbanan? But the blood didn't rest. He murdered innocent children. He killed the young Kohanim. Nebuzradan killed 94 myriads over the blood. It didn't rest. So he looks at this blood and he says, Zechariah, what do you want me to do? I've tried to avenge your blood as best I could. I've murdered countless. I've murdered the best. Nichalach did katilna lekulu. You want me to kill everyone? There's no one left. Miad nach. The blood rested. So what happened next? This is the whole reason we're bringing this story here, because Nebuzradan here tshuva bedaite. All of a sudden, he was struck by thoughts of tshuva. He had just witnessed something very supernatural: blood that doesn't wash away, that isn't absorbed. I don't know why it's freezing in here. Blood that doesn't wash away and that isn't absorbed. He watched. He experienced something supernatural. Amar, he said, "Mayim shalei ibdu ela nefesh achas kach." If they who only took one life, punished so severely, who gavra matehele, arak shadar purtita lebesei, and keep reading with me, vizgayer. So he says they killed one person. Look how many of them I killed. Look at the losses they suffered, and they only killed one. They killed Zechariah. You've killed so many, what I'm going to suffer. So he all of a sudden fled. He ran to repent, to transform his life, and vizgayer, he converted to Judaism. So the Chukas Hager of Steinberg quotes this precedent, and he says, this Nazi, is he worse than Nebuzradan, Babylonian general, the blood that was on his hands? I don't know, when you get to that level of evil, I don't even know if you offer comparisons at that point. But are you going to say that he was better, he was worse? How could you say? So therefore, if Nebuzradan was eligible to convert his Gayer, then maybe this Nazi too. And the Gemara tells us even further. Gemara gives us a list. Naman ger toshev haya, Nebuzradan ger tzedek haya. He was the highest level, not a ger toshev. He didn't accept the Zayin Mitzvah B'nai Noach. He went all in. Ger tzedek. He became a full-fledged Yid, a holy Jew. A Jew. But moreover, Mibnei Bonav Shal Sisra Lam De Torah B'Yushalayim, the descendants of Sisra, the Plishti, that we know with Malav the Torah, the shofar on Rosh Hashanah after his mother. Sisra's descendants are learning, probably in the mirror. Mibnei Bonav Shal Sancheirav Lam De Torah B'Rabim. Sancheirav, who scattered the Jewish people, taught Torah in public. Uman Ninu, and who were they? Shmaya V'Avtalyam, the Zugos in Pirkei Avos. Mibnei Bonav Shal Haman Lamdu Torah B'Bnei Brak. Haman's descendants learned Torah in B'nei Brak. V'Af Mibnei Bonav Shal Oso Rasha, even Nebuchadnezzar's offspring, his progeny, learned Torah. Because she goes Baruch Lachnis and Tachas Kan Feshkin, Amal Kasharz, and goes Baruch Barashalam. Mishihachrav is Beischav, is Sarav, is Heichalacha, Tachnis Kan Feshkina. They protested. At least this one they protested. So again, he brings and he references this Gemara in Sanhedrin as a precedent and as evidence that there are people who have done terribly heinous and egregious things, and yet they remain eligible for conversion. If Cain could murder and do tshuva, if Nebuzradan could be moved by his story in the Heichal to run and to be Isgayer to convert, if these offspring of these other evil and wicked people can convert, then so too this Nazi perhaps can convert. Now, what's the argument why he can convert? What is the status of a convert? We have a famous Chazal in several places in Shas, Gershon is Gayer, ke Katan Shenola Dami. A convert who converts is as if they are born again. Halachically, Midoraisa, they're not related to their own relatives. They're not related to their own relatives. Midrabanan, you can't marry your sister. Midaraisa, you can marry your sister if you convert. Ad kidei kach. That's how far we go. Gershon is gayer kikatan shenola dami. Footner is a beautiful piece in Pachad Yitzchak Shavuos that at Matan Torah we had the status of Gershon is gayer kikatan shenola dami. What that meant for Klal Yisrael. So a convert who converts is as if they're born again and they're born anew and they take it and they start from the top. So let me ask you a question. Let's say you perpetrate the greatest fraud in financial history. You're non-Jewish. And you owe countless Jews money. You only took Jewish investors. And you perpetrated an enormous Ponzi scheme and fraud against them. And you say to yourself, you know, I have a great chap. I owe $3 billion because of my fraud, my Ponzi scheme. If they take me to a Beis Din, a Jew could take a non-Jew even to a Beis Din. They take me to a Beis Din, I'll be responsible and liable for $3 billion. I know exactly what to do. Let me go to the mikvah. And when I come out, Gershon is Gayer, Kikotin Shinola Dummy. And I'm no longer. They're going to come to me and they're going to say, no, cough it over. And I'm going to say, who? Cough what? I don't know what you're talking about. I never had such a brokerage house. I never ran such a hedge fund. I don't know. Cotton Shinola Dummy. Wasn't me. Never happened. What would the halacha say? Does he owe them the money or not?
Sure.
Gershon is gayer kikatan shenola dami. What?
That's for my sharing.
Maybe.
It goes to motivation, the way you suggested earlier.
What do you mean motivation? Oh, good. So let's say he converted for the right reasons. We'll change our scenario. Good, excellent question. Let's say we change the scenario. He doesn't convert because that's the way to exonerate himself or relieve himself of those debts. He converts because he sincerely is motivated. Is he exonerated of those debts? Good. So Dina de Malchus Adina we're not dealing with. You're right, according to the laws of the land. But let's say in a Beis Din. What? Oh, excellent. So we're going to see this tshuva by Rav Yair Bachrach, the Chavos Yair. But I'll tell you that this is just to take you on another detour for a moment in our Smichas Chaver program, the wonderful program of Yada Goldvecht, not only introduced but now is exploding everywhere. So last man, we learned together Hilchos, among other things, Hilchos Tvilas Kalim and Hechsher Kalim and so on. And we had a fascinating discussion there. We actually learned this on Shavuos night for 2 or 3 hours together. The fascinating discussion of when the convert converts, do they have to tovel the Kalim they owned when they were a non-Jew? So the The Shem Yishmuel, the Sachet Shavah, the Shem Yishmuel quotes his grandfather who says that when he's in the mikvah, they're still at home, but ki'ilu, they convert with him. He holds that. Then Rav Asher Weiss, there's a lot of tshuvas. We're not going to review the entire thing right now. We discussed two fascinating questions. The conversion is scheduled for Monday morning at 11 a.m. Sunday night, the convert made dinner in his house, and he ate dinner, but there were leftovers. He's practicing to become a good Jew, so he saved the leftovers. He converts 11 a.m., he goes home for lunch, he's hungry, he wants to eat the leftovers from the night before. Can he eat them?
No.
Why would you say he can't eat them? Is it bishalakum? Is it bishalakum for him to eat?
Yeah.
Do you apply bishalakum to somebody who converted, to the food he made before he converted? And that question itself is, for others, maybe it retains the status of bishalakum for others, but for himself, can he eat the own leftovers, and maybe now he can't eat the own leftovers? We once had a conversion candidate, once, who throughout the entire process of conversion never ate food that he cooked for himself. Because he said, if the process means I have to practice living all of halacha, among halacha I have to observe is to be nizar and bishalakum. So he wouldn't eat his own food. Of course, that's not the normative practice, right? So could he eat his own food? And does he have to tovel his own kelim? And that also revolves a little bit around this question. Do the kelim come with him? Are they new kelim? Did he acquire them from a non-Jew? When the non-Jewish convert converts and becomes Jewish, the halacha tefilas kelim is you have to immerse in a mikvah something that you acquired from a non-Jew. Do we view that he's acquired this? And who was the non-Jew he acquired it from?
Himself.
Is that called an acquisition? Did he acquire it? If anyone wants, I could send you the tshuvas, the source sheets I have on this question. So back to our question. The Chavos Yair is the following. Maybe. Don't ask on Smith. That was just a detour. You can't ask questions on detours, only on the core of what we're learning. So the Chavos Yair is source number four. The Chavos Yair of Yair Bachrach, 1639 to 1702. This is tshuva ayin tes in Chavos Yair. And he asked the following question. Sorry. Yeah. This tshuva was published in the year 1699. So Chavos Yair says, a Ger Tzedek, a convert, meeting with the Beis Din, and he says the day of the conversion, after he comes out of the mikvah, after she comes out of the mikvah, she says, you know, I owe someone money. I stole money. Now that I came out of the mikvah, am I kikatan shenola dummy and I am exempt, exonerated? Or do I still carry that debt even after? How far does Gershon Isgar kikatan shenola dummy go? So says the Chavos Yair, b'gemara perek acholetz tanya, he's quoting this Chacham Echad, So the Gemara Nevamos makes it sound like that a katan, a ger, a convert who converts, literally has pressed a hard reset. It's brand new. And nothing about his past or her past remains connected or associated with them. Achim b'toysis perek ben sorer, Tanya bebrayses ben Noach shem Yisrael baal yishtov and his gayer im lanishtanis misas lachmar chayv misa chen pasak Rambam v'eksha atosus mihad de gershin his gayer v'kosu sheish l'chalik ben dinei adam l'dinei shemayim v'im kein vaday mochuyiv l'hachzer agzela. If you look, you want to see the Tosfos inside, I have it on the next page. Source number 5 is that Tosfos in Sanhedrin Ayin Aleph, where Tosfos there quotes this contradiction and ends up concluding the last line of Tosfos, a nearish yesh lechalik, to kula shmaitim b'dinei adam, v'hasam b'dinei shemayim. When do you apply the principle Tosfos the Rambam? When do you apply the principle of katan gershon is garik katan shenola dami in halacha in dinim bein adam lamakom, but bein adam lachavero, you're not katan shenola dami. You carry with you the experiences and the associations of the past, Mikom makom tzarch. And Rabbi Bachrach goes through. We don't have time to learn the whole tshuva. Skip to the next underline. The whole experience of being a non-Jew versus a Jew is all ben adam lamakom. When you are a non-Jew, the assumption is You weren't a ger toshav. If you, as a non-Jew, were observing the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, so you weren't a Nachri. You're not an Akum. In other words, you're fulfilling the Torah's view for you as a non-Jew. So what were you then? A pagan, an idolater, a kofar, a heretic. And what was the experience of becoming a Jew? Being mekabel ol malchus shamayim, monotheism, the ribono shel olam and his expectations of us. Kilu also so ma'aseh b'yadusa v'asa tshuva. Lachen lo yo lo giyusa b'davar shechayva alav misas beizdin, k'mo shel yo gam ken b'Yisrael yidei tshuva. Just like the experience of Geirus, the Chavos Yair makes a parallel between the experience of Geirus, the transformation of Geirus, and the transformation of Tshuva. Just like in the laws of Tshuva, the damages I've done, the injury I've caused to another person, all my sincere Tshuva in the world can't relieve me of the accountability or consequences until I'm a Fayez Chavero, until I make the other person whole and receive their forgiveness. So just like Tshuva, that the Jew undergoes in order to transform, require, has a difference between Ben Adam Makam and Ben Adam Chaveru, so to Gerus, which is the tshuva of the non-Jew, also only works in the realm of Ben Adam La Makam, but Ben Adam La Chaveru, you still have the previous or former status. Because Makam Basher Ata Hu Yisrael Lenuchal Ladunim Mises Ben Noach Gam LaLahachmir Mises Yisrael Chamura Vidok. Then he continues on the next page, which is his conclusion. Page number 5. Whatever chiyuvim. By the way, you could say even differently. Forget my scenario of the horrible Ponzi scheme. You schedule to go to the mikvah Monday morning at 11 a.m. Go borrow money from everyone you know at 10 o'clock in the morning. And when you come out of the mikvah, you say, I don't owe you any debts. I don't have any debts. Gershon is Gaia Gershon Oladami. Would you say you have no debts when you come out of the mikvah? Of course. And therefore he concludes that a guy who stole when they were non-Jewish, even after they become a Ger Tzedek, they still carry the consequences. So Rabbi Pollack in his article says, based on this Chavos Yair, that maybe Nevuz Radon was accepted to Gerus. And maybe he repented. But who said he wasn't accountable for the acts of murder that he had performed? Bedine Shemayim, maybe he was forgiven. But Mises Beisdin, if Mises Beisdin were still enforced, you know what would have happened to Nevuz Radon? He'd come out of the mikvah, we'd say, Mazel Tov, Yashkoyach, here's your certificate. And then we'd walk him to kill him. We'd give him a capital punishment. We'd put him right to death. We'd probably have to try him now and try him as a Jew. And of course, using all the loopholes that we have, we would try to exonerate him. But he, at least in theory, in principle, would be put to death. So he disagrees that maybe the conclusion of Rav Steinberg in the question of the Geru comes is, maybe there is a reason not to accept him. Because you're right, strictly speaking, with the strict rules of halacha and its criteria, we have no right to reject the Nazi. But if we understand that even after they convert, Gershon is Gaia Kakut and Shinola Dummy, they would carry the blood on their hands. And if there were a Beis Din still who could give Misa, you'd likely put them to death. So maybe like Nevuz Radon, you'd accept their Geras, then put them to death. Or maybe you'd argue you shouldn't even accept their Geras to begin with. So that is the first question of, is that Tshuva fully compelling, that even with the strict halachic principles, that you would have to accept him? Or maybe even with strict halachic principles, you could argue that someone who b'dinei Adam would still be chayev mises beis din is not somebody who we should be accepting as a ger tzedek. It's an interesting question. This is compounded by the fact that in order to be eligible, you should have to receive forgiveness. We said gerus works like tshuva, and tshuva ben adam lachavero, achi efayis is chavero. So how would you, in order to be eligible to be a ger, receive the forgiveness? Even Simon Wiesenthal thought that there were, even this is forgivable, who grants that forgiveness? Who is empowered to grant that forgiveness? So the Gemara in Yuma tells us, Nav Pei Vav, Am Pei Zayin, Kol HaMaknet Es Chaveru Afilu B'Dvarim, Tzarech Lefaiso. V'chulei, v'chulei, v'tzarech lefaiso b'sholosh shurosh, shlosh b'nei Adam. You have to even ask three rows of people. We talked about this actually this past Yom Kippur. The burden shifts. After you've asked forgiveness three times, then you have to be willing to let go. You have to be willing to forgive. But what happens? Three times. V'meis. What if the person that you hurt died? Maybe asar ben yado ma'amid al kivro v'omer chatos l'shem l'kei Yisrael if lo nid shechavalti bo. You have to go to the grave of the person that you've hurt, and you beg forgiveness from them at their grave. So the question is, the 6 million, most of the Kedoshim don't have graves. We went to Poland together. You stand in Majdanek at the end, the ash pit that holds literally tons of human ash. All of Europe is a graveyard of Jewish blood. Whose grave do you even go to ask forgiveness? As if you could go to the grave and ask forgiveness. So therefore, Rabbi Pala concludes that it's not so pashut. If you look, this is the conclusion of his article, source 6, page 6 rather. Problem, of course, is the 6 million have no graves. Monument made up of 7 tons of human ash stands today was the death camp Majdanek, a supreme monument to the absence of graves. We complete the second dialecta by claiming that because there's no place at which to ask forgiveness, the commandment can no longer be properly fulfilled. The tradition recognizes the perpetrator's capacity to seek forgiveness, but in the absence of locus, denies him the right to accomplish it. The perpetrator is relegated to a realm of marginality, halfway between heaven and hell, in which he is aware of, even regrets his crimes, but remains powerless, perhaps in perpetuity, to get past them. Which is a fascinating conclusion. Because the crime was so egregious that it left no grave from which to ask forgiveness, the person becomes the victim of their own crime, in the sense that no matter how genuine they are in asking remorse, they can't ever fully achieve it. And because they can't ever fully achieve it, Rabbi Pollack, who already identified himself as a survivor, is unwilling to accept the gerus of such a person. It's a complicated halachic question. I doubt it has come up often. It certainly won't again because that generation is gone, maybe of their children. I was curious. I told you this case of the German Jew and the German non-Jew, and the German non-Jew now converted. And after the day of the conversion, I asked a little bit whether she was curious about her own background and what she had learned about it. But let's say she had learned terrible things about it.
Ask anymore after she became a Jew.
It was before. After the Kiryas of the Mikvah, you couldn't ask. You're right. The last I want to end, we have a couple minutes left. I just want to get to it at least briefly, is this question of boycotting. You know, we Jews are against boycotts. We don't like BDS. We don't like people using boycotts against us. So what statement are we making? Is it a noble statement? Is it a just statement? Are we only hurting ourselves by not buying German products and the like? So there's a tshuva that Rav Aviner has. Rav Aviner is the Rav of Beit El, the Rosh Hashiva of Ateret Kohanim, in Sheila Shlomo, page 7, the last page. And he discusses this question very briefly because we are out of time. But he says the following. Should a person refrain from buying German products? We don't find in the strict halacha, we don't find any prohibition of benefiting from the products of murderers or wicked people. You can't sell weapons to evil people. Maybe they'll use them in order to murder. Actually, there were halachic discussions about Israel. You know, Israel sold arms. Israel sold arms to less than reputable nations. And there was halachic literature about, at least moral literature, about the morality, the halacha of selling weapons to less than reputable nations. So there he says it's also, they maybe use it. Mm-hmm. But if you're not selling weapons, you're not going to say that you can't do business with them. Throughout the generations, Jews did commerce. We transacted with our neighbors, and by definition, they were almost always wicked to us. Again, if we said that there's a prohibition of transacting or doing commerce with those who hate us, we would have been in big trouble. So Sefri learns from the Pasuk in Vayikra, it's preferable, of course, just like it's preferable to give your family first, and then to give observant people first, and then to give a Jew first, and then to give good people first. That doesn't necessarily exclude Germany. That would put a preference to give the Jew business over anybody else. Is that discriminatory? Is that biased that we give the Jew business? So let me ask you a question. If your brother's in the business, and a non-Jew is in the business, and a stranger's in the business, who would you give the business to? Is it discriminatory to give it to your brother?
Sure.
Your brother's a travel agent, and the Stam Mepis travel agent. Who are you going to give the business to? What kind of family member are you if you don't give your brother the... That's what the Torah is trying to inculcate within us, is that we're a nuclear family. And we give family first.
The Jews first.
We're not discriminating against others by saying, give the Jew business, don't give the non-Jew. What we're saying is, every Jew is my brother. We've explained this often, the Isser of Ribbis, the prohibition of Ribbis. Is charging interest unethical, immoral? Of course not. There's a time value to money. There's a time value to money. If I give you my money for whatever period of time, I've lost the usage of that money that could have returned me a profit. There's a time value to that money. And the fact that I forfeited the time value of that money, I'm entitled to recover it. Interest is purely moral and ethical. So why can't I charge it to a Jew? Because no matter how compelling the argument of the time value of money, if my brother asked to borrow some money, I'm a real lowlife if I charge him interest. So we're supposed to see every Jew as our brother. It's the same idea here. Number three. No de shesh mala luknos be Germania, yeleza geder hachatish al midas chasidus, shinesun le shikula shakalacha ve echad. Vod gam nasun le shikula shakodem muchan lahotzi yoser kesek de lemon and the toast Germanis, says also kesi yitzalotzi al midas chasidus acheris. He actually says, Rav Aviner, I don't know his own family background. He grew up where in France, no? Rav Aviner? He grew up in Europe somewhere before he moved to Israel. I don't know his own family background. But he says, if to avoid buying the German product, you're going to pay a premium, the German product is less money. And you're going to pay the premium because you refuse to buy the German product. He says, better, what you're really doing is saying, Midas Chasidus, not to buy the German product. He says, better to buy the German product and give the money to Tomchei Shabbos, to Jewish education, to a kollel, to a yeshiva, to the Eruv, to the kashrus. Find a different Midas Chasidus than the fact that you won't give the money to a German. That's his end. Number four. He says, nobody established this because we don't establish something that people aren't going to observe. And Jews need their BMWs and their Mercedes and their whatever else that they need. And therefore, Rov HaTzibur are not going to do it, so therefore we didn't enact it. Number five, Mashal Davadoma, when investigating this question, and we can do this next week if you want. It's a fascinating, or in 2 weeks, it's a fascinating question I once gave a whole shir on. Is a Jew allowed to visit Spain today? I'll tell you why it's relevant. Spain. I'll tell you why it's relevant. There's tshuvas about this. Why is it relevant? It's relevant to contempt. This class, at least for now, is called contemporary halacha. So I have to find the contemporary hook. Why is it? Because the Spain invited Jews who were expelled to have citizenship returned. But it's running out. It's the last chance. Spain is going to give this free citizenship, open citizenship, to any Jew who was expelled. The question is, can you take it? Why can you not take it? Look what he says. There's a shmua that went out in our Masorah, in our tradition, that after Spain expelled the Jew, it's quoted, it actually traces itself, they say in the name, back to the Abarbanel. Although, if we do that sure, you'll see that it's not accurate. But the Abarbanel himself said, once Spain exiled and threw out the Jew, we look at Spain and say, you didn't break up with us, we broke up with you. We have no interest in coming back, we have no interest in being here. To the point that there's a halacha question, can you even go visit Spain? Rav Yosef Karo, the Baal Shulchan Aruch, himself was expelled from Spain, and he authored the Shulchan Aruch, and he doesn't record this. Rav Yitzchak Bar Benel, Shafu Gorish, Rav Bar Benel, Mesaper Eskores HaGerish, Ach Ein Remez L'Cher Medvarov, Luma Zos HaMabit, Shu Ben Doron, the Mabit, who was of that generation, Rav Trani, Ein Sham Yehudim, B'tuchim Shalo Ya'olod Shem Yehudi, Ki Akeh Yizborach Yikabetz. So you see, even those who were expelled from Spain didn't create a cheirim to benefit from Spanish products or to go on a Spanish vacation. No, that's what he's saying. They reject the fact that it was a rumor that there was a cheirim. It's not true. Rav Yosef Karo, who lived it, doesn't record it in Shulchan Aruch. The Abarbanel, who lived it, didn't record it. The Mabit alludes to it, but that was the personal preference of the Mabit not to give Spain any business. He says, Hagon Rav Meshulam Rat, who was a, Rav Meshulam Rat wrote Chayos Chuvas, anyone know what they're called? There's a beautiful town named for him right outside Yerushalayim with the yeshiva. maybe some of your grandchildren went to. Anyone know what it was called? Mevaseret. Mevaseret Zion. Shaul Shubis Vaser. Meshulam of Meshulam. Rad Dan B'Sheilim Lassor Knisa LeGermania. Shaul Zos Mishtei Sibos. So he deals with this in his Chuvos Kol Mevaser. That's the name of his Chuvos. Number one, he says Iav Shalachadish Gzeres Achraya Talmud. Omnam Hayuharbe Takanas Chacham Al Ir Achas Vafilu Al Medina Achas Achlo Al Yadus Kula. He says, we don't enact new enactments after the close of the Talmud. Particular communities can accept things for themselves, but we don't do it wholesale. Number two, Ein Gozer and Gzera, Elam Kein Robat Tibur Yochel Amaba, Afilu Chazal Mitzrayim, Shu Isser Men HaTorah. We could also give a shir about that. We could talk about all the places we can't go. The Torah in three places, three psukim. This is not some Chayram Baba Maisa. The Torah in three places says, Hashem took you out of Mitzrayim, don't go back. One Shabbos ago, though, we went through this topic. And we talked about Mitzrayim is not only a geographic place, Mitzrayim is a state of mind. And when the Torah says in three places, don't go back to Mitzrayim, it means the geographic place called Mitzrayim, and it also means to the state of mind and the philosophy called Mitzrayim. But there too, the Rambam lived in Mitzrayim, Rav Avadya Yosef Zatzal's Yerushalayim we just observed lived in Mitzrayim. Hayudim lo amdu bo v'yikimu sham kilos, g'dol yisro tzuchu l'ulma b'hem, tzuchu l'lamed aleim s'chus. Number seven. His conclusion, Ravi Ner, is there is no halachic prohibition to use German products, but if you want to abstain, God bless you. But don't abstain at a cost, you're better using that money in more meaningful ways. It's a personal preference. So, in honor of commemoration of Kristallnacht, we saw this complicated question. Are the things that are unforgivable? And how, if a Nazi wants to ask forgiveness, can they? And if it is forgivable, are they eligible to convert? What are the halachas that are included within that? And should we boycott their products? Mitzvah Hashem, we'll see you next time.